It's the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. JD, Blake, and Ailish. A perfect day for Text Line Tuesday. Hit us up 590, 590. Raptors, heavy conversations today, I assume, in that text line. After they breezed by the 76ers, 103-88. JD, I know I'm always the optimist on this show. So you know my answer to this question, but are the Raptors officially back in the series?
Yes, they absolutely are. And Blake, just, you know, both of you making my day today. You with the nice intro where it's, are they back in the series?
Beautiful.
And I get to reply yes, because I thought the series, like everybody, was dead at 3-0. And getting to steal Philadelphia's song and repurpose it as Toronto's is an even lovelier feeling. Because I heard that, and it's like a Pavlovian whistle of good things are about to happen, where I get to be happy and feel joy because I love that show. That's the theme song of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And it really was sunny in Philadelphia last night. I don't know how you, as a Raptors fan, or as a casual NBA observer, as someone who's watched sports for the first time, as a hardcore Philadelphia sports fan, not have watched that basketball game last night and have gone, oh my God, one of these teams is pooping their pants and the other of these teams is starting to take off.
The gang goes up 3-0 is the Always Sunny intro tagline there for that one.
Yeah.
We're going to do text line later, so send your text in 590, 590, Raptors or whatever you want to talk about. But we're going to do the first ever edition of the text line from Philly. I have a couple of texts for later from 76er fan friends. It's not good. If you were wondering,
we'll have to censor them.
If you were wondering if the Raptors taking two off of Philadelphia, and for context, 14 times in 146 instances now of a team getting down 3-0 in a series has a team forced a game six. This is very rare. It happens about once every 10 or 11 3-0 series. So something special here. If you thought that it was just Raptors fans, you know, thinking it's playing with house money, getting the energy up with low pressure, it's not. It is a house of cards in Philadelphia, and it makes me think that everything we said before the series, and when they were down 3-0, we did a lot of, oh, well, you know, we said if this happens, then this, and then it's a series. Well, that stuff's happening. It's just a little delayed. You've got a Doc Rivers, James Harden, Joel Embiid, Philadelphia 76ers fan cocktail brewing, and no pressure on the Raptors.
Okay, so I want to start with this, that a lot of the confidence that this fan base has in the NBA world at large when it comes to the Sixers losing the series is that, make no mistake, if the Sixers lose this series, the Sixers blew this series.
Oh, it's one of the most historic choke jobs in NBA history, even though it's the first round.
So let's not make that confusion of me saying that this isn't on Philadelphia, right? Like, you have the best player in the series in Joel Embiid. You have a future Hall of Famer in James Harden. You have a future Hall of Fame head coach, even though Doc's record in these elimination games is getting to the point where you almost go, how can you be in the Hall of Fame? Honestly, like, we know you did Ubuntu, but man, it's getting quite embarrassing for Doc Rivers here. There's no doubt about it, right? You have home court advantage. There's all these different things at your disposal. So part of this is that, one, Harden does not look very imposing. Let's just say that when you stay home on James Harden defensively, and OG Anunoby did a great job yesterday, and I thought the Raptors team defense, like, we'll get to that in a second, but Harden just, if he's not a setup man, if he has to be a scorer, it's just so clear how the difference is between him and Houston versus the Harden that we're seeing right now. Embiid, I have found now multiple games in a row where the Raptors have just taken him out of the game early, and Philadelphia has not been able to get him kind of rolling or have him feel consistent throughout the game. The thumb thing is obviously affecting him. But the Raptors deserve a lot of credit for yesterday's game. Like, yes, Philadelphia is going to blow this series, but to me, yesterday was about the Toronto Raptors. That team defense, Blake, I texted you during the game, and you're busy doing all the post-game stuff. We talked about a whole bunch of other stuff, but To me, that was the greatest defensive performance in Raptors postseason history. Like, if you look at games 4 through 6 against Milwaukee, those were a triumph. And I'm really not trying to diminish those whatsoever. And Giannis was the MVP in 2019. So you go, all right, they did slow down the MVP. But I think Milwaukee was at a little bit of a different point in the track than where this Sixers team is supposed to be. And if you just look at this Sixers team, the talent that they have, the fact that they probably also have the league's MVP, and the fact that Toronto held them to under 90 points and like an effortlessly under 90 points on their home floor in an elimination game that they needed. And the way they did it to me was beyond spectacular. Like, that was as good as anything you saw from the Boston Celtics, who our guest Tim Bontemps yesterday said was the greatest defensive team in his lifetime.
So game 3 of that Milwaukee series, which was that crazy double overtime one, yes, is kind of my high water mark for, like, what is backs against the wall elite playoff defense look like. And there was a lot of nonsense in that game too, but that was nonsense both ways. Like, that was just the theater of the absurd. And yes, you go back and look at that series, and it wasn't even the scores in the game are low, but a lot of that was pace based. Milwaukee was still scoring kind of efficiently. They just made Milwaukee do it with 6, 7, 8 left on the shot clock. Last night was a masterclass. And so Philadelphia averaged 0.77 points per possession when the Raptors got them into the half court. So you're talking 77 points over an average length game if Philadelphia played every possession in the half court. That is wild. They weren't a ton better in transition either, percentile-wise, but that's a fifth percentile offensive output for Philadelphia, and that's for the whole season. So that you're talking, you turn them into a bad night for the Sacramento Kings or a regular night for the Oklahoma City Thunder, and they have Joel Embiid and James Harden and Tyrese Maxey, who, by the way, we haven't talked a ton about because Embiid and Harden are obviously the focus. They've done a dramatically better job on Tyrese Maxey the last two games as well.
Well, you just look at the closeouts. It's the way that they're just closing on everything all of a sudden. Like, throughout the early parts of the series, and Danny Green has still benefited from wide open threes where they have just allowed him, and obviously Matisse Thybulle, which you can't say that they didn't have Thybulle in Toronto, Sixers fans, because that's a blessing for you. Like, I had a thought yesterday of someone force him to get the vaccine so that he can come here and keep missing shots. That's about as bad of an offensive performance as I've ever seen. And I love that player, but boy, oh boy, was that just a complete meltdown. But how many times did the Sixers get a little bit of dribble penetration from Maxey? You saw Raptors players be able to stay in front of him or swarm to the basketball, and then an awkward kick out, right? Where the ball doesn't go to someone immediately, like, that's close. There's no easy outlet option. It ends up having to skip to someone. The ball moves by Philadelphia a couple of times because no one wants to take this shot. It gets hot potatoed around because Embiid didn't get deep post position all game. And then it ends up in a corner where you're expecting someone to have a wide open look, and it's a semi-contested three late in the clock for a Tobias Harris type. Like, that was happening over and over and over again. They're not letting Maxey get to the rim. Even the shots that he did make at the basket were impossibly hard. Did you see that? Well, obviously, did you see? Oh. But that one shot that he made was gorgeous to the point where I went, oh, this guy's my favorite player in the NBA now.
Yeah, like, that's going to be on posters in Philly kids' room once they get over the trauma of the 76ers blowing a 3-0 lead.
Well, I don't think that there's going to be any posters of Sixers stuff ever in Philadelphia.
Yeah, but Maxey will be around for the next era. So yeah.
I don't know. I think you got to basically go scorched earth if they lose the series.
So, but one of the things that we've talked about is, and this is for years with this Raptors defense, is just how difficult it is to be on a string enough to be as aggressive as they are, try to force as many turnovers as they do, protect the rim without a traditional rim protector where everyone's 6'8", 6'9", and then also get back out to three-point shooters. Last night, they held Philly to 63% shooting at the rim. That's a really, really good mark, especially when you don't have a rim protector and you're going up against Joel Embiid. Philly also shot 1 of 9 in that kind of like 3 to 10 foot floater range. So when they couldn't get to the rim and they pulled up short or were trying to do a hook or a push shot, they were 1 for 9. So the Raptors did a really good job inside. And then, yeah, Philly has a tough, tough, tough shooting night, 10 of 37 on threes. Danny Green's the only guy hitting them reliably. And I know, look, you could go through the tape and there's one or two here and there where, oh, maybe that drops another time. Maybe Tobias Harris hits three in an average game, whatever. But the Raptors shot 8 of 31 on threes themselves. They shot 26%. You won a playoff game where you couldn't shoot at all, in part because your defense did all the things your defense wants to do, and your defense took care of those secondary things and those tertiary things of, okay, this is the priority, but if we're going to win a playoff game, you also have to do this, 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 and this. And they did all of those things. They protected their offensive glass, except for the Paul Reed minutes. They got out on shooters. They forced a lot of turnovers. It was, I mean, I don't even know what you do for a film session if you're the Raptors coaching staff today. You just kind of pat them on the back for the defensive performance and say, please do that again, please.
No, you send the tape out to all the coaches that are going to request the tapes. That's all you're doing with it. There's going to be team after team after team that go, can you send that over? So to me, it was a validation of the 6'9 stretch.
Vision 6'9, yeah, as they started calling it.
The ability to defend out to the perimeter that way is very unique. And I know nobody wants to hear this, but this is what I was talking about when I said this isn't the series for Fred VanVleet. And if you're talking about what's changed for Maxi, that's the main thing, is you're no longer being guarded by Fred, who he was blowing by all series long, getting to the rim, forcing the Raptors to collapse, and opening things up for shooters on the outside, but also things at the rim for him. Like, the team looked completely different without Fred in the lineup last night. Like, the three-point shooting wasn't there the same way, but the defense was, yeah, completely different from what it's been in the series, having a hobbled Fred VanVleet, a slower Fred VanVleet, and upgrading him essentially to having Boucher in lineups and Thad Young in lineups. It's just the size difference has been notable, and I don't know how you could attribute the Tyrese Maxey thing to, like, you don't want to boil it down to one thing, and it feels kind of like you're kicking Fred while he's down with an injury, but I just thought that this look for the Raptors is the way forward for them in this particular series.
Yeah, and it's not the Raptors are better without Fred. It's that the Raptors in this particular matchup might be better off without a 50% Fred trying to gut it out, right? Like, we're talking about a knee and a hip injury. We're not talking about a thumb or, you know, your non-shooting shoulder, something like that, something that you can adjust your game to. We're talking about you don't have bursts. You don't have the ability to move laterally. Fred VanVleet's a guy who plays through a lot of stuff. And for him to be, like, as early as shoot around yesterday, be like, nope, I'm not playing, and, you know, I don't know about a game six.
But I mean, before the injury, Blake, because he had the hip injury new. Like, I mean, that this series wasn't a fit for
him. He's been dealing with that anyway, but yes. So it is not the best series for a not 100% Fred VanVleet. I still think, obviously, in the half-court offense and stuff, you'd want his spacing. A healthy VanVleet still helps on the dig downs on Joel Embiid and stuff like that. But before the injury, like, I was on the Raptors show with Will Liu, and we were kind of redesigning what the defense might look like, and it was, well, it wasn't take Fred VanVleet out of the lineup. It was put length on Tyrese Maxey, and if that dares you to have Tobias Harris or Danny Green try to beat Fred VanVleet, so be it. And that was kind of where we landed on with how he fit defensively in this series. So, I know you're not doing this. I saw some people doing this yesterday. I wouldn't go too much further than this isn't a good matchup for a half-good Fred VanVleet. But yeah, you see the Vision 6'9", right? You see the Siakam and Barnes can be the point guard. Thad Young can play a little point guard. Everyone can pass, dribble, defend at least three positions, sometimes five for some of these guys. You know, you see OG and Precious switching an Embiid Harden thing. You see Thad kind of capable of guarding both of those guys. You know, Thad's not a guy you want on an island at this point, but he's the smartest defender you have right now, and his ability to make Embiid work for position and for post entries and stuff like that, they were just clicking. And even I thought it was remarkable too that, like, things worked that well on a night that Gary Trent didn't really have it a ton offensively either, because, you know, we laid it out yesterday that I thought that was going to be the big thing, right? Like, you have to get that secondary scoring from Gary Trent Jr., and you didn't, and you still survived. So kudos to that defense. You definitely see what Vision 6'9", or whatever it is they call it, is all about, where Precious, Siakam, Ananobi, Barnes, and Trent are all double-digit plus-minus. Anytime those five were on the floor together, it was killer, it felt like.
You might not have gotten it from Gary Trent, but you certainly got what you needed from Pascal Siakam. And yesterday was the conversation, hey, you know, he's got to have another great performance. Can he string together two incredible playoff moments where he had spent all season silencing the doubters, proving people wrong, becoming that all-NBA player that we wanted? It's very fitting now that he's done it twice when his back was up against the wall in the playoffs. I know that that second game gives you a little bit of a bad taste because, well, hey, where was it then? But that's all you can do now is put that in the past and continue to be elite. And he's done that with two master classes back to back. So seeing him able to rise to that occasion once again makes you feel completely confident in that he has that mental fortitude that we wanted him to have. And, you know, that was another incredible performance from him. And he also kind of shouldered some of the missing Gary Trent not having his best game and Fred VanVleet not being in the lineup.
So for me, it was very much I'm over the bad loss at this point. It hurts them, and when they lose the series, it's definitely going to be a part of this if they do, right?
Yeah, you got to move on from that one.
If they lose the series, you have to mention that there was a game where Siakam really hurt them. He and Fred really cost them game three. Like, this series should be tied if you get those guys at a normal output or even a 75% game.
You'd be up.
Yeah, exactly. You'd be up in the series. So it's definitely still a component, but to show that resilience and to come out and play that way twice in a row, if Siakam can continue this series this way, it's honestly legacy-changing in the city. Mm-hmm. Like, last night, what impressed me more is game four, you're on your home floor, and you get very aggressive, you get a good whistle. There were some shots in game four, let's be honest, where it's like the three that go off the backboard. There was a few shots in there that were like, okay, there was some fortunate shot making in that game. He played great, there's no doubt about it, but it was definitely a game where like everything was going well for Siakam. That game last night was more impressive to me because whatever the Raptors needed in whatever moment they needed it, Siakam gave it to them. It was the playmaking. It was the defense. It was the ball handling. It was the shooting with confidence. Like, how many shots did he hit from long two that you went, oh, my God, that was actually a little different than some of the stuff you've shown us in the regular season? How many times was he turning his back to a defender, going late in the shot clock, and then turning and having great confidence and getting that shot perfectly and knocking it down? I just thought that almost every time the Sixers looked like they were going to make a run, Siakam took it upon himself to either make a great play for somebody else or to knock down a great shot. Outside of the little stretch Precious had where he just barbecued Embiid, I thought Siakam had that game on a string. That was a beautiful performance by Siakam.
What's most impressive to me is that we just saw Pascal Siakam be the best player in consecutive playoff games. Again, first of all, against a team that has Joel Embiid and James Harden, but in two completely different ways. Where game four, it's all about scoring and no one can guard me and you're going to try five different guys on me in the fourth quarter and I'm going to live at the free throw line. And then you come out yesterday and, yeah, he started out well. And then I thought, you know, I don't know if this was like an edict or something that he took on himself, but the start of the third quarter, he goes into scorer mode. And to me, that felt a little bit of like, we're not going to let this slide. Like, we're not going to cough this up and let your crowd back into it. I'm going to kind of carry us here. And then down the stretch, to use all of that defensive attention, you know, to create for others. And JD, you mentioned the long twos. He had three of them in the game. And then you see late, like, yeah, he has... His stat line is obviously good, 23-10-7 with only two turnovers, and he shot really efficiently.
And both turnovers came at the very beginning of the game.
Right. But the assist total doesn't even do it justice. Like, there's that play. It was basically the game-sealing play of like, okay, this thing's over, where he drives and Philadelphia completely collapses to keep him out of the paint. There's three guys and someone's shading off of Gary Trent as well to help on Scotty Barnes, who's cutting. And he finds Scotty Barnes and Scotty makes the really quick kick out to Gary Trent for three. And that doesn't show up on the box score for Pascal, but that's entirely a play where we talked about the spacing concerns you're going to have without Fred on this in this lineup, and especially on a night Gary Trent and OG Anunoby don't shoot it super well. That's the kind of passing and ability to not just anticipate what a defense is going to do, but manipulate what the defense is going to do. And it's huge. Like, I know that people call it a hockey assist or secondary assist or whatever. It doesn't show up in the box score, but that was very indicative of just the way Siakam operated against heavy, heavy, heavy defensive attention, because Philly was concerned with him first and second and third, basically.
One of the times that I was most impressed with Pascal yesterday was the start of the third quarter. And a lot of momentum was riding on actually the Sixers starting to get it down to single digits, and the crowd had come back in their favor, which was hilarious. All of a sudden they're cheering, then they're booing, then they're cheering. But the start of the third, he was massive just to slow it down and to not give the Sixers anything to build on, especially coming off like a halftime. Like, I know sometimes you're in the locker room, like, you get a chance to flush the first half and say, hey, like, let's start fresh. And the Sixers obviously needed that mentality, but he came out, he shut it down early in the second half. And I think that was that leadership and that drive that you want from him to say, hey, no, we're going to keep control of this game. We're not going to let this get in our heads, that they started, you know, getting a little bit more in control of the game. And that's the leadership that you want from Pascal Siakam. And to see that in a big moment, just that's one little tiny thing that I noticed that was really integral for the Raptors to continue laying on the pressure for the rest of the game right there.
We probably do this too much in sports, but I thought that, you know, one of the things I love about basketball is that you're truly naked out there, right? You're wearing shorts and a tee, and there's no helmet. People can see your face. We can see your body language. We can see the way that you're carrying yourself. And you're also, you're the creator, right? Like, it's like you going head to head with the other team. And Siakam last night, you could just see his body language. It was the great version of Siakam that we've seen all regular season, right? It was this guy with real bite to his game yesterday. There was no fear. There was no slouch moment for him. You could tell that it was confident wire to wire. And I agree with both of your points. I thought that Siakam, you're right, Blake. If I'd love to get the, what is it, Sport VU of how many secondary assists he had yesterday, or how many times that he was the point of attack where even where shots weren't dropping. Because again, you mentioned how the Raptors were like, 26% from three yesterday, 27% mm-hmm. from three. I'd like to know how many times his actions materialized in a clean look for the Raptors, too, that they didn't end up knocking down, or some of the shots that they ended up missing off of Siakam. And you're right, Ailish. He really did show a lot of leadership and poise starting that third quarter, where you knew Philly was going to come out of the locker room, where they needed a punch, mm-hmm. and Siakam was essentially the silencer. Do you guys think that Philly can win? Like, how do you feel about Philly winning in Toronto versus in Philly? Because I actually feel like with all the ghosts in that stadium, and the way that crowd responded, where they hurt their team yesterday. And I'm not blaming them, because that's just being a fan. You can do whatever you want. But to be booing your team in the first half of a game, in the first quarter of an elimination game.
Outrageous.
I just feel like you put a game 7 there in Philly, I'm going to be feeling amazing. Like, that was the other thing.
Up in the series 3-1, and you're booing your team and leaving.
I think the thing I feel most strong about is it's going to 7 games. I feel like, and I said it yesterday, the Raptors win in Philly, the Sixers have their back against the wall. You know, the narrative down south is choke job. These guys are they're blowing the series. And Toronto fans are going to be incredible on Thursday night. Not that they haven't been before, but just imagine they're going to blow the roof off Scotiabank Arena. So completely different to play in front of your home crowd that would never, I don't think, boo your team in the first quarter of the game, I hope. I think that there's a lot of positivity heading into Toronto. Like, the series is now, why not us? You know, this has never been done before, but we can be that team. And JD had that tweet on when they were down 3-0 about if anyone's going to choke, it's going to be this team. And you're completely right. And I just feel so confident in what this team can do, this gritty team back home. I don't feel confident at all.
I'm saying Philly
needs
to win this game here, though. Like, Philly needs to win it in Toronto.
Yeah, I don't feel like they can.
Yeah, okay, because I don't think that they're going to win the series, because I don't think they're going back to Philadelphia. Like, this to me is set up where Philly now has Tuesday and Wednesday to rest, right? They get the two mm-hmm. days in between games. They got to get Joel Embiid thinking, hey, you and James Harden, this is for your legacy now. Because you bring this game back to Philly, and you guys have tied the series. If you give up the first basket of the game, they're going to boo you out of the building. They are going to lose their minds. And I'll tell you this.
They'll
leave
after the first quarter like they did last night.
this is the one reason why people think that, one, Harden is a choker, and two, that Embiid is soft. And I'm just – James Harden, okay, we know losing your explosiveness makes sense. Where's the three-point shooting? Like, why can't James Harden, who's one of the greatest scorers in the history of the game, who hit threes as well as anyone I've ever seen, his step-back three, Blake, is where is that? What happened to his step-back three? That's to me choking. But Joel Embiid, the way in which he kind of checks in and out of these last two games, where you can get him out of it early. He's bitching and crying about the refs. That clap at the ref and that quote to the refs that Embiid had after game four.
And to on top of all that, to get hit with a $15K fine.
That's going to be the least of his
down
worries.
Back.
That's going to be the lowest price that he pays out of all of this. They blow this series. I do not, when we're talking about Siakam's body language versus another star, Embiid's body language over these last couple of games has been horrific. And if I'm Philly, and you don't get that whistle early on in game six against the Raptors where they're not calling every single touch foul, I'd be pretty nervous. Like, this just, I have not liked what I've seen from Embiid whatsoever. And I texted you that he'd quit on defense in that game. And they said on the broadcast that he was tired, and I believe that. But there was some plays there where he's just, boy, it was kind of embarrassing for your star player in a must-win game to basically just be conceding the rim to guys that are, you know, 5 inches shorter than you.
Midway to late through the third quarter, the Raptors scored against Embiid on five consecutive buckets. Not five consecutive possessions, but they kept attacking him, and five scores in a row came with Embiid as a primary defender. And you saw it in a couple different ways. You saw Precious kind of just roasting him. You saw Pascal Siakam. You know, earlier in the series, he gets Joel Embiid on a pick-and-roll switch, and he's hesitant there, right? He's maybe probing for a long two or pulling it back out and resetting. And he was like, no, I'm taking the edge on this, and I'm going to have this bank shot, this kind of runner falling out of bounds on the baseline. And it's like there was no question in his mind whatsoever that he was going to be able to take Embiid. Precious Achiuwa, like... Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone told him that Joel Embiid is like one of the best defenders in the NBA.
He
does not care at all. Six of six inside the arc for Achiuwa last night. And he hit his free throws.
Part of my criticism of Siakam in game three about being afraid to go at Embiid through the first three games of the series was that Precious Achiuwa was getting it done when he was called upon to go at Embiid throughout the entirety of the series. Like, this isn't a new thing for Precious. This is something he's done since game one, which is when he sees Embiid, he doesn't see a guy that's in the conversation for DPOY, right? Joel Embiid was crying at the beginning of the playoffs that he wasn't considered for first-team All-NBA, or that he wasn't going to win Defensive Player of the Year, that he was not being considered, blah, 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 blah. I didn't see that against Precious Achiuwa. Achiuwa does not care about that whatsoever.
No.
He doesn't feel that way.
Precious has like the defender version of face blindness, where he doesn't know who's on him. Just like, I'm going to blow by this guy or shoot a jumper in his face. Like, it doesn't really matter to me.
So I want to finish on those two things then, because again, it's been, to me, this is the primary stories were Philly choking, Embiid fading away, Harden being a complete non-factor, the Raptors' defensive performance, then Pascal Siakam. But then after that, again, I don't miss Fred in this game because Scotty can do what he does as that point guard. I thought Scotty set up so many people in great positions, like sneaky, also awesome playmaking game from Scotty Barnes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he only has the four assists, but that's one of those things where I check the box score and I go, how did he only have four assists? I felt like he had way more than that.
And like his ability to cut, especially along the baseline, opens up a lot of stuff, right? Like, there's more to spacing than just three-point shooting. It's taking advantage of the spaces a defense gives you. And his ability to cut that way for baskets or cut that way as a safety valve for a Siakam. And then, I mean, the play I mentioned earlier, Barnes cuts into Siakam's passing kind of tunnel that he has available there and then immediately kicks it out to Gary Trent. It's like, yeah, I mean, we talk about shorting the pick and roll sometimes where you swing it to the other side to avoid attacking the actual pick and roll defense. It's like, yeah, it's kind of the same thing where instead of Siakam having to kick it out over three guys of length, Scotty just kind of cuts into that space and makes the pass for him. They're starting to figure out some nice synergy there between the two of them.
They really are. But I just think like Scotty and Precious in that game were awesome. Like, both of them, a lot of the Raptors deserve credit. I thought OG Anunoby staying fearless throughout the game is like, that's OG, right? Where he's one of, I think, eight of three until he hits the game icing shot. But he, like we said yesterday, doesn't shoot to miss, and he's the kind of guy that isn't going to stray away once the game gets to a big spot like that. But Scotty Barnes, again, the fearlessness that he displays as a young player, I think we need to discuss that a little bit just with Precious Achiuwa as well, because I think Precious is 22 or 23 years old, and this is his first like meaningful action in the postseason where he's being called upon, and he's showing that he's willing to go at Joel Embiid. And I think we're all probably in agreement that one of the biggest sweats you feel as a Raptors observer in these games is Nick Nurse likes starting those quarters, those halves with Kem Birch, where he goes, I want 6 minutes of Kem, and then I'm going to go never see Kem again. And you're going, I'd like that to be 3 minutes of Kem, maybe. You know, I'd like that to be 3 minutes to start halves of hard fouling Kem and then get to Precious Achiuwa, because everything he's doing for this team is clicking. The defense, the rebounding, he didn't hit the three yesterday, but you know that you trust the spacing right now. And then, yes, the ability to get to the rim. It's been an incredible progression this year from Precious Achiuwa, coming from a guy that you didn't trust being anywhere around the basket to all of a sudden a guy that's flushing on Joel Embiid with regularity.
Well, yeah, the secret, it turned out, to Precious Achiuwa finishing at the rim was don't pass it to him at the rim, just let him take it there himself, and then suddenly he's an elite finisher. He's been awesome, and we talked a lot about his defensive growth over the course of the season. His finishing improved a little bit during the regular season, not a ton. It was more about the three-point shot and the confidence dribbling the ball, but this guy, like, by the end of the year was like playing like an all defense caliber guy. He is very switchy and very effective. You don't even need much from him offensively for him to be a positive contributor. Mm-hmm. And you're getting that. And JD, you're right. He's 22 years old. And I think the combination of him, OG, and Scotty being the younger part of this core and being just completely unfazed by the moment, like Scotty Barnes is playing through an injury and looking like probably their second best player in the games that he's played in. You have Precious, who's again matched up with a guy who is in the MVP discussion and doesn't care. And then you have OG, who there's no situation where he won't be confident that he's OG. I thought OG had, I mean, OG has had the defensive series, but man, the last two games, he has been just out of this world on that end.
I think it is the biggest determiner between why I feel confident about the Raptors is I trust way more players on their team to be contributing factors. And the depth, we've talked about it all season, is something that they kind of surprised us with. I didn't really feel most confident about some of these names, and now they have showed up in the big moments. And maybe the Sixers have the best player in the series, but the Raptors have maybe the best next three or four players that are contributing consistently that you didn't expect coming into the series. And one thing on Scotty that I loved last night, and we were talking about how he's been able to show up in big moments with the injury, the fans are standing up on their feet for the first time, clapping after something, and he comes down the court and throws two incredible assists and shuts them up like immediately, and you know, changes the momentum of the game. And he can put that already in his game as a first-time playoff contributor, and that leadership as a young guy, and to do that fearlessly, it's been incredible to watch Scotty in the games since he's returned and game one. So you feel confident about that. Two more days of rest for Scotty coming back home. Like, I feel like he can only really benefit from that, hopefully. And so that's why I feel even more confident about Thursday's game back home and what he's already proved in the game since returning.
I think the rest benefits Philly more than it does Toronto. Just because
they got some guys banged up that look exhausted.
Well, and they also, they have, like you said, less guys you trust, right? Mm-hmm. Do you guys feel good when Shake Milton comes in the game, or Paul Reed?
From a Raptors perspective?
Yeah,
I feel very good when Shake Milton comes in the game.
And, you know, this is, Ailish, to your point of trusting more Raptors players than you do Philly players. I think this is the interesting point of the series is, not do you just trust them just as competent NBA players. You trust just their defense, right? Like, modern NBA, there's always players that you attack. There's a matchup that you're looking for, right? Niang comes on. He's a brilliant three-point shooter. Like, he's terrifying on that end. Every time he gets even a crack, I go, is this guy Steph Curry, but 6'9 or whatever? Like, he's unbelievable at shooting the ball. But the rest of the game, the Raptors are attacking that matchup. They attack James Harden. And James Harden's not like a slouch defensively, but you can attack him. You can attack Tyrese Maxey and the size of Tyrese Maxey. The Raptors with that 6'9 lineup, they can get advantageous matchups. You see, like, Siakam trying to force it into switches where he can shoot over the top of it. You see them trying to get OG to post up on him or Scottie Barnes to attack him downhill. Like, there are matchups that they like. Even actually getting Embiid out of the paint and trying to get Gary Trent Jr. to pull him out and then create off the dribble, there are things the Raptors can attack. There's nothing that Philly has that they go, well, that's what we want to go at against the Raptors. There's no guy that you're pulling out of the paint. Oh, what? You pulled Precious Achiuwa out? Okay, good. Who's the player? Even Gary Trent Jr., he deserves a lot of credit, I think, Blake, because he's not the best defender in isolation on this team, but he has just dug in completely. He's doing the Fred VanVleet school of every time you're putting a ball anywhere within my airspace, I'm taking a swat at it. And you know what? I'll take two or three fouls a game on reach-in fouls, but I'm also going to get a couple of turnovers every game that are going to turn out into fast break opportunities. They're a beast defensively right now. And I got to think, like, anybody, again, at any level of basketball should be able to relate to what Philly's going through right now, which is that when you just all game long as a player get no space or feel like there's not one guy that you get to attack and build a little confidence off of, it starts to wear on you mentally. And that's where I think Philly's at right now, is that none of them ever get an opportunity or a matchup where they can just be free and score. And now that Fred is out of the series and you don't have an undersized guy that you can shoot over the top of or someone who doesn't have his legs underneath him that you can blow by, there's just nothing there. There was no airspace for Philadelphia in that game, and I don't really expect why that would change in Game 6. And that's why it's going to take a Herculean effort from Joel Embiid or James Harden or Tyrese Maxey or all three of them to beat this Raptors team. Like, it's going to take a phenomenal individual performance to overcome that.
Yeah, and the one thing that Philly did have going for a little bit that they went to was there was a stretch where Joel Embiid started doing a better job getting that deep post position early in possessions, whether it was in transition or just offensive rebounding opportunity. And Thad Young countered that. I know Thad only played 16 minutes last night, but Thad was the counter to that, and Thad was a counter to the zone. So one of the things with depth here is, like, we've said this for a few playoffs now, is it's not just about having the best offensive players or having the best defensive players. It's having the best offensive players who can't get played off the floor on defense, or having the best defensive players who can't get played off the floor on offense. And Niang and Thybulle are such an interesting contrast to the guys the Raptors have on, where, yeah, George Niang is a better three-point shooter than any of the Raptors' depth pieces. Matisse Thybulle is a better individual defender than any of the Raptors' depth pieces. But neither of those guys can reliably play 20, 25 minutes in a game like this, because they can only really give it to you on one end of the floor. So if you're the Raptors, maybe you take a Thad Young or Chris Boucher, who, you know, don't have the single skill utility that those other two guys have necessarily, but you can't attack them on defense, you can't ignore them on offense, and everyone can contribute a little bit. And this is, again, this is part of the 6-9 vision thing of, if everyone can handle a little bit and everyone can defend a little bit, and it's like, yeah, you don't have that 1A top five superstar, but you also don't have anyone in your seven-man rotation, because Kem's kind of a style unto his own with these guys, but everyone else you can trust to put the ball on the floor, attack a closeout, make a pass, flash to the center of a zone, defend a couple positions, and that's really valuable. It's not a ceiling thing necessarily. You still need a Scottie Barnes to pop or Pascal Siakam to play like he's played the last two games, but it's a heck of a floor, and it's a heck of a floor against a team that can't figure out what to do when Joel Embiid's not on the court, or what to do when, you know, Doc Rivers tried that lineup last night of no Joel Embiid and no James Harden.
I don't know why he ever did that. That's honestly on Doc Rivers, where you go, hey man, this is why you lose these games.
Like, yeah, the guy who barely has a 500 record when he's in when he has a 3-1 series lead.
That was unbelievably dumb early in the game where he
and the Raptors capitalized on it.
Of course they did.
Previously, they hadn't really owned those minutes. Game two, at least. For you to be like, hey, like, this is our chance to keep running up the score. Like, that's
maybe you thought Harden was fatigued and, like, he ended up playing 40 minutes or whatever. But, like, what did you get James Harden for if not to help shoulder those non-Embiid minutes? I don't know.
Harden had five turnovers in that game. Embiid had four. Both of those guys were obviously frustrated by the Raptors' defense to the point where they're throwing the rock away. And
the bigger stat for me with Harden was only 11 field goal attempts.
Yeah. Yep.
That's but, like they, we've talked about this all series, and the Raptors have like slowly nudged it in this direction of, and JD, you said it earlier, is you're turning Harden into a scorer. You're daring him to beat you one-on-one, and you're saying, hey, if you still have this James Harden, we'll take it and we'll lose that way, but you got to show us you still have it, and the help's coming later, or the help's not coming as aggressively at all, so that you can stay a little closer to three-point shooters. And James Harden, at least so far, hasn't been able, I know he had 22 points last game, but not in a dominant way or a way you're particularly terrified of, not to a James Harden level. And yeah, 11 field goal attempts, 7 assists, 5 turnovers last night. Hard to imagine a worse James Harden line other than the ones we've seen before in the past when he was a Houston Rocket.
Yeah, I just think if you're looking at this as a Raptors fan, like Ailish, you started this with, are the Raptors back in the series? And we've gone over a billion different reasons why, but James Harden's lack of burst and just lack of commitment to getting into the paint and trying to be a scorer, that's one of my main points of confidence. And we talked about this series when we started it, and we all picked the Raptors in 6 or 7, and this is why. Because we didn't think Harden was the same guy. We thought that they might crumble. We thought that Embiid might wear down. We thought that Coach Rivers would get out-coached. Like, all these things are starting to sort of become the way that we thought they were, just maybe not in the way that we thought it would happen. Let's take a break. Again, it's Text Line Tuesday today. We're going to do it at 7 o'clock, so, and throughout the show. So keep banging them out. Whatever you want to talk about today, but I'm guessing that it's going to be very rare, very heavy Raptors show. I want all the Raptors takes, all the Sixers takes, all of that different stuff. We've got Jeff Van Gundy at 8 o'clock. Daniele has booked a big show. We got Will Liu coming up at 9 at the top of the hours. But we've got the A-List next on the morning show. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Covering the Raptors in depth like no one else. The Raptor Show with Will Liu. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Morning show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. It's Text Line Tuesday, folks. Hit us up at 590-590 in the DMs. JD, Blake, and Ailish. Follow us, subscribe, download all the good stuff wherever you get podcasts. Funny night for some things in the sports world. One of them has to do with the President of the United States. Let's get into it, Vic.
Now, it's time for the A-List.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
What's up, baby?
An honored tradition as a Stanley Cup winning team to go visit the White House and to be celebrated for your success. And Joe Biden, you know, it's not usually a massive night. You just have them over. You take some photos. You give them a little speech. But we got a little audio clip of Joe Biden having a funny little slip up. Let's play that.
I want to thank Commissioner Gary Batman and for being here as well. And at the risk of stating the obvious here, it's a pretty good time to be in a sports fan.
If you missed that.
Yeah.
Gary Batman started the rounds on Twitter. He really does say Gary Batman. Continues, doesn't correct himself. And if you've seen the video, which I obviously can't show you through the airwaves, but Victor Hedman just loses it in the background. He is just howling away, laughing it up. All the players noticed that he called him Gary Batman. A really funny little slip up. I know Batman is out in theaters. Maybe Joe Biden was just hitting it up, watching our Batman. But it was a weird little slip up for someone of that.
Probably because Gary Batman looks like the Penguin.
Honestly, yeah, kind of.
Maybe.
Yeah, he's like, look at that little guy, Penguin. It's like his Batman. I just think this is, you go, hey, it's a funny little slip up. And I go, yeah, kind of. And he's not the first president to mess up somebody's name at this media car, especially with hockey, right? This happens all the time with the hockey players. I think it happened to maybe not Ovechkin. I'm trying to remember the most recent one where somebody won and got their
something
name.
Something happened. It feels like something's happened lately quite a lot.
it does. But the difference here is that Joe Biden is the oldest 80-year-old who's ever lived. Like, honestly, he's
doesn't bode well for people.
Every time he gets in front of a microphone, it's like, I'm barely conscious. I'm so tired. Someone please put me to bed. I've never seen a, like, he inspires the least confidence in any of any human I've ever seen in my entire life. Like, Joe Biden, I can't believe is president of the United States. Like, Donald Trump is still the most shocking president that has ever existed in the United States, where you go, I can't believe. Think about how many times you guys had the I can't believe Donald Trump is president thought. Like, almost every time, right? You go, how do we live in this reality? But that this is the other guy, this like 80-year-old man who's really just battling dementia on the daily. Like, it's just quite a thing watching this guy operate. Every time he gets in front of a microphone, you're like, are you gonna fart on live TV again? Are you gonna fall asleep? Are you gonna mix up words? Like, what are you gonna do, old man? You gonna ask for porridge? Like, what are you gonna do? It's bad. It's so bad watching Joe Biden.
So yeah, he did another little blooper. Seems to be a little bit.
I can't believe
trend.
He farted on TV though. That one time, he just ripped that huge fart on CNN, and he tried to pass it off like nothing happened.
Unfortunately,
and
I don't have the audio for that one.
That's just old guy stuff where you can't hold it in, and he's just like, "Yep, yeah, it's got to go. This has to go." Boy,
okay, so I got another little audio.
Strap in, America. You got a lot of good things to look forward to up down there. It's looking great.
Apparently, the messed up one in the text line was Steve Eiserman, Bush, maybe pronounced
it wrong.
Yeah,
that one, yes,
Bill Clinton,
that one
somebody.
That's
100%. The one. Thanks, text
that's
line.
The biggest one. But there was also one that recently just happened. But anyways, sorry, continue. Yes.
Keep them coming if you have the info. Okay, another funny little audio clip. Well, maybe nice. It depends on your perspective, and maybe it sparks some interest of what you would do. So, Paulina and DJ finally got married, which I didn't know they weren't married.
Pardon me?
Yes. Dustin Johnson and Paulina Gretzky got married this weekend. And yeah, that was a little bit
what?
Shocking. Yeah. Did you not know they were married? I didn't either. I thought they had been married for years.
What? How long have they been dating?
I don't know. I thought they were married and had a full little family, but they were not married. So this weekend they have their wedding, and they have a special...
They have two kids that are 7 and 4.
That's correct, but they didn't get married.
Not like you have to be married, but it's just like...
It's just a bit shocking because, you know, most people go that route. So, okay, so they have a special musical guest, and I'm going to play it right now, and you have to guess who it is.
Guy from Wedding Crashers singing at their wedding. Old school.
Oh, yeah.
But yes, I didn't know that actually. I didn't know I could just hear it in the thing. That's awesome that they got him, but they've been engaged since 2013.
That was
Kid Rock,
in case people don't know.
Oh, I thought it was the guy from Wedding Crashers.
No, it was literally
school.
Kid Rock, who they got for their wedding singer, which is the weirdest selection of all time. Like, I didn't know Kid Rock was doing stuff, and why are you getting him to play a Chris Stapleton song?
I mean, if you can get an 11-time platinum recording artist to play your wedding, and he wants to play a Chris Stapleton song, you let him do whatever he wants.
Kid Rock is a good country singer. Like, there's no doubt about it. The guy's a lunatic person, but he's a good country singer. Like, that song Picture with him and Sheryl Crow is number... That's, like, one of the best country songs of all time. And it also is the number one if you are in a relationship and can actually do a duet karaoke song. Like, if you could pull that off, you guys are couple of the year. Like, if you go pull that off at karaoke, you're actually now couple of the year. It's a little cringe. That's why you have to do it well. But if you do, but engaged since 2013, that's the bigger story here. Like, you guys are missing the biggest story of the entire A-list. Like, that's a decade of being engaged. Like, I don't even understand. What is the point of being engaged if you're going to go a decade?
Engaged for months and years, and they just never have a date set. That was Paulina and DJ.
I'm so disappointed. I was going to ask, my question was going to be, how long were Pam and Roy engaged for? Because that was a joke. Where it was a massive joke on the show was that these two have been engaged forever.
Now imagine instead of Kid Rock, you got Scrantonicity to play your wedding at the end of that.
But that this is 10 years of being engaged. Wow, that's...
They definitely weren't engaged for that long. I think it was like 2 or 3 years, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Usually when you get into... I was going to say, what do you guys think is the awkward...
There's a movie called The 5-Year Engagement.
Yeah.
Emily Blunt and Jason Segel.
I think once it crosses the two-year mark.
The whole thing is that 5 years is an incredible amount of time to be engaged for. It's a whole movie, and they doubled it.
And Paulina, okay, it's like, no offense to these two, but what do you got going on? Like, DJ couldn't leave. Like, people get married at golf courses, DJ. You could have just gone and done 18.
And you're not
like,
saving up for money. You're set.
Exactly. Like, you're set for the cash.
Just go to Wayne Gretzky Estates, and you could get married there easily.
Yeah, you're set for the cash.
You've got
booze companies within the family. You have golf courses at your disposal to get married at literally anywhere on the planet for Dustin Johnson.
Look, Brantford, Ontario's wedding season is hard to book. You got to book ahead of time.
I need to know I actually need DJ to answer for this. Or Paulina, one of them to answer for these crimes of a 10-year engagement. That is just, you know what though? Shout out to any dude or woman out there who does pull off now a long engagement and gets to go. DJ and Paulina were engaged for 10 years. They had two kids. It's not a big deal. It's pretty normal, actually. Like, shout out to the celebrities normalizing outrageous behavior.
Yeah, so you can sprinkle some of those engagement texts in the text line 59059. We got a couple about presidents making mistakes in speeches, but we'll get to that and more of your text after the break. It's the Fan Morning Show. Hit us up 590-590 on the text line. We're going to get into some more Raptors, Jays, Bo getting out of his slump, whatever you want to talk about. That's after the break. Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.